part of the regular shiur, but it was the fourth that I had yesterday. So I was visiting my parents. I discovered a bag of potato chips, which apparently were left over from Pesach. And I said, okay, so I'll have a bag of potato chips. So I opened it up, and I tasted one of the potato chips. It was incredibly, incredibly stale. And I didn't really feel like I wanted the rest of the bag. I gave one to my son. He didn't really look like he wanted the rest of the bag either. And my mom took one. He tasted it. It's like, wow, these are very, very stale. So there were no real takers. So I took the bag and I put it into the garbage. So now you have a garbage pail with a bag of potato chips inside of it. The potato chips are stale, so they belong in the garbage pail. But at the same time, theoretically, let's say that my son decided, you know what? You know, these potato chips are really yummy. You know, like he wanted some more. So I wouldn't go to the cabinet and look for another fresh bag of potato chips. If my son liked those potato chips and wanted more, I would have just taken them out of the garbage and given him the rest. They were still inside of their bag. They were pretty well preserved. So I think that that would be a good solution for the garbage during Bein Hashmashos. Right? Because the dilemma was that, you know, if you put something that doesn't belong in the garbage into the garbage, so then the garbage doesn't become a buses for it because it doesn't belong there. Right? But on the other hand, if you put something that belongs in the garbage too much in the garbage, so then it becomes mukta, and it doesn't save the garbage from being a buses. But if you put this type of bag of potato chips, you know, stale potato chips into the garbage, on the one hand, it belongs in the garbage enough that you know, that the garbage becomes a buses for it, and at the same time, it doesn't belong in the garbage so much, right, that it's beyond, you know, rescue, and so the garbage, you know, it becomes a buses to cover a mutter. So I think that, you know, everybody should maybe buy a lot of potato chips on Pesach, and every Erev Shabbos, if you don't want to take out the trash on your way out, just put one of those bags of potato chips into the garbage, and that's going to rescue it from all buses shilohs. Oh, okay, that works also. But I don't know whether the non-Pesach potato chips really become stale the same way that the Pesach ones do. Yeah. Could be. You know, the Pesach stuff is the only stuff you don't have to throw out for the next Pesach. So moving on from there, we just want to quickly finish up. We had seen a number of different reasons that were given for why Chazal made the Gzeira of Muksa. And so we saw the Chayei Adam, right, the idea that you prepare before Shabbos and then you implement the plan on Shabbos. We saw that Rav Huttner quoted the idea of mindfulness, so whenever you pick something up, you should always ask yourself, how is this object going to enhance my Shabbos experience? If you don't have a good answer, then don't pick up the Kli Shel Malach LeLis or the Kli Shel Malach LeHeter. You're always asking yourself, how is this movement, how is this object going to enhance my Shabbos experience and make Shabbos a more mindful time? We pointed out the Ravid, who said that the whole point of Mukta is in order to avoid Hotzah, to avoid carrying outside the Erev. The fewer things that you move around, so the fewer things that you're going to end up carrying outside of the Erev. That was a Ravid, and there's some very interesting leniencies that the Ar Sameach draws from this Ravid. Then we saw yesterday a couple of extra things that were quoted in the Rambam. The Ravid says he doesn't know where they came from, but at least two of them you should have been able to find in the Gemara that we read yesterday. So one thing which the Rambam said is it's not just a concern that by moving things around you'll be over on Hotzah, carrying out of the Eruv, but you might be over on any Melacha. Pick up a Kli Shemalachto Le'isser. If it's a hammer, so you might end up being over on bonet. If it's if it's a needle and thread, so you might end up being over on sewing, and so on and so forth. If you pick up a pack that's only used for cooking and not used for storage, like a frying pan, so then you might come to be over on cooking. And that's why consistently, both according to Abaye and according to Rava, the halachos of Kli Shemalachto Le'isser are much more strict than the halachos of Kli Shemalachto Leheter. We're much more strict when it comes to mukta for objects whose main use is for malachos, because part of the zera of mukta is based on a concern that you might come to do malacha. So that's something which seems to emerge from the Gemara. Again, the Gemara never says explicitly mukta is asur because you might come to do malacha, but if you look at the pattern, at the shape of the halachos and you see where muktzah is more strict and where muktzah is less strict, then you end up getting this idea that part of the gzeirah of muktzah is to protect people against doing malacha. In addition to that, we saw that of the multiple repeals of hilchos muktzah, so for the first three repeals, the only things that you were allowed to move around were things that you were capable of moving with one hand, that are things that one person was capable of moving, were capable of moving. So that means that during the first three rounds of legislation on muktzah, a table like this would not be allowed to be moved. You wouldn't even be allowed to pull it out, right, or to push it in, right, to get to get to your seat because it's too heavy. What does heaviness have to do with muktzah? So we suggest that fits together very nicely with what the Rambam says, that the purpose of muktzah is to ensure menuchas haShabbos. We're nervous that people are going to get bored and they're going to end up spending their Shabbos doing all sorts of heavy, drudging, type of labor, and they're going to lose the whole idea of menuchas haShabbos. So the gzeirah of muktzah for those first three rounds of legislation said, something, the only thing you can move is something which is light, something which you can move with one hand and or with one person, and that's in order to remind people and ensure that menuchas haShabbos is preserved, that it really has that restful environment which is most promoting of spiritual reflection and deepening of relationships with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What remains to be discovered, though, is what about the other two reasons that the Rambam gives? The Rambam says that number one, the purpose of muktzah is to ensure a shisa hanikares. It's to broadcast, right, this message that Shabbos is a special day. So where do we see that in the Gemaras or in the laws of muktzah? Logically, it makes a lot of sense that by acting differently on Shabbos, that you're going to be broadcasting that message. Shabbos is a special day. Right? We wear special clothing on Shabbos to broadcast the message. Shabbos is special. We eat special food on Shabbos, right, to broadcast the message. Shabbos is special, and so on and so forth. But so muktzah fits in with that framework, but where do we find an indication in the halachos, right, or in the gemaras about muktzah? That remains to be discovered. So that's more or less on what we covered yesterday. And today we move on to an analysis of the machlokas between Abaye, here's mine, Abaye and Rava. So let's take a look at the Gemara. We're on Kof Gimel Amud Beis. And again, we left off with the machlokas about two different halachos. Number one, can you move something whose main purpose is allowed on Shabbos in order to prevent it from getting damaged? And the second one was klisha malachto le'isser, but sorach mekomo. If there's something whose main function is not allowed to be done on Shabbos, are you allowed to move it if it's occupying space that you need? And the Gemara is going to try to prove this. So we're about 2, 4, 6, 8 lines up from the bottom. See, there's a star on the, before the fourth word of the line, Esei. We're going to have a couple of challenges. Esei Abaye. Midocha, you've got this grinder, spice grinder. And yesh bashum metaltulin osa. If there's still spices inside of it, so then you can move it because now it's sort of in a tether state. It's being used for storage rather than being used for grinding. But in lav, but if there's nothing being stored inside of the grinder, then ein metaltulin osa, you're not allowed to move it. So that seems to suggest that Abaye says that we're very restrictive when it comes to muktzah. He says, why are you not allowed to move it? Obviously, because even though it's a klisha malachto leheter, you can only move it with tzorach gufo. This is not tzorach gufo. You're talking about just moving it for make space or something like that. The simple answer is, and we're not talking about moving it to make space. That would be permitted. And we're talking here about moving it to prevent it from damage, which is not allowed. So again, basically, you've got this spice grinder. It's a kli shem alachto le'isser. You're not allowed to move it if it's empty. Why not? So Rava says you can't move it to protect it from damage. Abaye says you also can't move it to free up some space. One, the both of them agree that there are circumstances when you can't move it. The only question is what those circumstances are. And again, we pass in to free up space, you are allowed to move it, but to protect it from damage, you are not allowed to move it. Continuing, again, we're just going to go through some of these challenges very quickly until we get to what we want to focus on today. Esvei, right, another challenge that Abaye has for Rava. Shavin, both Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai agree. Shem Katzav, Olav Basar, that after you use this cutting board, right, on Yontif, we had this on the top of Amud Aleph, She'asur L'taltalo, that you're no longer allowed to move the cutting board. Again, we're assuming that we're treating it like Kli Shemalachto L'Isar on Amud Aleph. We treated it like Mufsa Machma Chesun Kis. Right, and again, the question is, it's a Kli Shemalachto L'Isar, why are you not allowed to move it? So Abaye assumes that you're not allowed to move it with Tzorach Mekomo, because you need to free up the space. Rava says, no, for that you are allowed to move it to free up the space. The only time that you're not allowed to move it, this mission is talking about Hachanami, Nechama Letzel. You're not allowed to move this cutting board to protect it from getting damaged. Amar Rabbi Chanina says, Bimei Nechemya ben Chachalya, Mishneis Mishnah Zo. That this Mishnah, the Mishnah that we started out, right, on the top of the Amud with, which says that you can, that you can't carry anything except for the three types of knives, that was taught in the days of Nehemiah, Dichsiv by Yomim Ahema, in those days when the Jews had just come back from Bavel and Chilul Shabbos was still rampant. Ra'isi b'Yehuda, I saw people in Yehuda, Dorachim Gitos b'Shabbos, they were pressing grapes on Shabbos. They put the grapes on top of the wine press, and they would jump on top of them and squeeze out the juice from the grapes, which is a malacha the araisa, and umevim ha'aremos, and then they would bring the piles of wine or of grape pulp, and they would sell all of these things. And so we see that there was this idea that the Chilul Shabbos was rampant. Nehemiah stepped into the breach, he closed the gates of Yerushalayim, like we described yesterday. And we have a tradition that this, the Braisa that says that everything in Muktzah dates back to that era, although later on many of those of that Braisa's provisions were repealed. So this generates a very interesting question. In order to understand this question, we need to go back into the history of Mishnayos. There's a big machlokas achronim about how the Mishnayos were composed. And I'm going to present you one of the perspectives. Everybody knows that the author of Mishnayos, right, or the editor of Mishnayos, is Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Right, but how exactly did Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi write the Mishnayos? Did he take a pen and compose the language of every single Mishnah? The answer to that is almost certainly not. What Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi did is he gathered up the Mishnayos, right, from many of Amoraim in Tanaim in previous generations, and he sort of edited them. Maybe decided what went in and what didn't go in. He may have certain times made certain editorial emendations. The Rambam says that he made this decision together with his whole yeshiva, which comprised all the Talmidei Chachamim of the generation. Definitely was a committee decision. He didn't do this unilaterally, but we ascribe it to him because he was the leader of the project. So he basically took Mishnayos that perhaps had already been, if not written, then at least composed and memorized word for word, and he decided this is going to go into the text, right, into the book that we nowadays call Mishnayos. Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, in his Sefer on the transmission of Torah Shebaal Peh, gives a very interesting explanation. He says that in every generation, the Gadol Hador, the head of the Sanhedrin of 71, members, used to compile his own Mishnayos, right, based on the teachings of his rebbeim, based on the votes that were taken by the sages, in his yeshiva. And every generation, the Gadol Hador would disseminate, right, that particular bunch of Mishnayos. And he would, that's what all of Klal Yisrael would study. Those would be the halachos that every single Jew would study, right, very similar to, you know, Halacha Yomi that goes out, you know, nowadays, right, on email, right, thousands, tens of thousands of people all studying the same Halachos, and that was overseen by the Gadol Hadar. And when the Gadol Hadar would pass on and the next Gadol Hadar would take over, so one of the projects that the next Gadol Hadar would have to do is to sort of update, right, that, you know, those Mishnayos to fit, right, both the needs of the new generation, right, and because, you know, he's his own person with his own rebbeim and his own, you know, view on halakha. So sometimes he would say, you know, in the previous generation, the majority of poskim said that this was aser, but in our generation, the majority of poskim, right, say that it's mutter. And so he would revise the Mishnayos to reflect the opinion of the chachamim who were the majority in his generation. But at the same time, in order to sort of preserve the historical continuity and the awareness of the historical process of the development of halacha, very often they would leave the same Mishnayos in, right, for many generations. So in other words, a Mishnah, perhaps that was out of date, right, would remain inside of the text that everybody was studying, and everybody would study it, but it would be understood, right, the Rebbeim who actually learned in the yeshiva of the Gadol Hadar, when he taught that Mishnah, he would say, by the way, right, this Mishnah reflects an opinion, right, which is rejected by the majority of Chachamim in our generation, right, or, more important in our case, he might say, this Mishnah is actually codifying legislation that was later repealed. So the fact that Hilchos Muktza, right, went through a multiple stage repeal process means that the task of studying Mishnayos about Muktza is fraught with danger unless you have a tradition. Because any Mishnah, you need to ask yourself, did this Mishnah predate the draconian legislation of Nehemiah? Was it taught at one of the earlier stages in the repeals, when many things that are mutter nowadays were still usur, right? Or was this Mishnah taught after the days of, you know, of the last repeal, where the halakha pretty much leveled out and it was as it is nowadays? So the historical era in which this Mishnah was taught, it is going to play a very important role in understanding whether that Mishnah is consistent with halacha l'maisa, or whether that Mishnah is a historical artifact to help us appreciate the historical process of halacha and how it develops, right, and the fact that halacha is basically a system of legislation, right, which is binding on us as citizens, right, of the the Jewish civilization. But at the same time, like every legislative process, right, there's a way that laws get enacted into law, and then there's ways that laws get repealed, and that's important for us to appreciate as we learn halacha as well. And the question is, what is the purpose of every Mishnah that's taught in connection with Hilchos Muktza? So the Gemara is going to give us four Mishnayos where there's a controversy over what is the purpose of including these Mishnayos within the over of all Mishnayos. According to one of the Amoraim, these Mishnayos are purely historical. The halachos contained in them were repealed when we took back the Gzeira of Nehemiah ben Chachalia. According to another Amora, these Mishnayos have contemporary relevance. In other words, that the halachos that are taught in these Mishnayos are halacha l'maisa even nowadays. And even if they sound like they're very, very strict, right, there's a reason for that. Now, if you say that these Mishnayos are not relevant contemporarily, so then you're going to end up adopting a little bit more of a lenient stance, because you're writing out four strict Mishnayos, right, from the corpus of Hilchos Muktza. And so the average, you know, level of stringency within Hilchos Muktza ends up going down a little bit. If you accept these Mishnayos and say that they reflect even the post-repeal world of halacha, so then you're going to end up with a little bit more of a strict approach, you know, to Hilchos Muktza. There may be certain silos which, based on these Mishnayos, we're going to end up being more strict about. And so let's take a look at the Mishnayos. We'll try to figure out which of the two approaches, which of the two readings of the Mishnayos is more authoritative, and then perhaps we'll survey some of the practical shilos, right, which actually emerge, right, from this discussion about whether to take a lenient stance or a strict stance on Hilchos Muktza. They appear in Mishnayos, yes. If you look in the Mesoras Hashas, which quotes where everything appears, you'll be able to find exactly where each of them appears. Amar Rabbi Elazar. So we're four lines from the bottom, fourth word on the line. Amar Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar says, Kanin, Umaklos, Glustra, Umedocha. The Mishnah is that of these four names, Kanin means like reeds, hollow tubes. Maklos means sticks. Right? A glustra is some sort of a bolt that you put through a door, right, in order to secure the door. And medocha is what we learned already. That's the grinder that's meant for grinding spices. And these are the names of four mishnayos. Kulon, kodem, hataras, kelim, nishnu. All of these preceded the repeal, right, of Nehemiah's Zera. In other words, all these Mishnayos are not halacha lemaisa, they are merely historical interest. What are these four Mishnayos? Number one, Kanim, the Tanan, we learned in the Mishnah, Menachos, Saf, Tadi, Vav, it looks like, Lo Sidur HaKanin, Lo Netilason, Doche Es HaShabbos. Background. In the Beis HaMikdash, in the Heichal, there was a shulchan for the lechem upon him. The lechem upon him were 12 loaves of bread that were piled in two columns of six. Now, what happens when you pile bread up is that it sometimes gets moldy. The moisture, right, gets trapped in between the loaves, and whenever there's moisture, there is bacteria, and the bacteria come and they cause the bread to get to get moldy and to get not tasty and not fresh. So in order to keep the bread fresh, it's important to ensure that there is circulation and flow of air, so that way the moisture can evaporate rather than just getting trapped there. And if the moisture evaporates, then there's less of a motive for all of these bacteria to come in and make the bread moldy. So in order to ensure that there's a flow of air, you're piling up six, big loaves of bread, they used to have these kanim, these hollow half tubes that they would put in between each loaf of bread and the next. So that way, because the half tubes were hollow, what ended up happening is that the air ran through, right, the hollow semicircle, and that allowed all of the moisture from the loaf of bread on the bottom to evaporate through that tube, and it didn't just get trapped by the loaf of bread on top of it. Now, we know that the lechem upon him was changed once a week on Shabbos. And it stayed fresh, exactly, although the kanim, I think, had a role in that. So the Mishnah says the simplest thing to do would be to take the fresh batch of lechem upon him, pile bread number one on the shulchan, put the two tubes on top of it, put bread number two on top of the tubes, put the tubes on top of bread number two, put bread number three on top of the tubes, and put the next set of tubes, and so on and so forth. But the Mishnah says, Lo Sidur HaKanim, Velo Nitilasam, Doche Shabbos. You can't do it because these tubes are muksa. You can't do it because these tubes are muksa, and you're not allowed to violate Shabbos, to break the laws of muksa, in order to put these tubes out. So the Gemara says, why are these tubes muksa? It says Rabbi Elazar. Are they klisha malachto le'isser? Are they designed to do something which you're not allowed to do on Shabbos? There's no problem preserving the freshness of bread on Shabbos. So the only possible explanation for why they're considered mukta must be because this Mishnah was taught in the days of Nehemiah ben Chachalia, where everything was mukta except for three types of knives. That's the only explanation for why these tubes are mukta, which means that when the Beit HaMikdash is rebuilt, according to Rabbi Elazar, you would be allowed to put these tubes in between the loaves of bread, even on Shabbos. We'll see that Rava or Rabba will give a different explanation, and he'll say, no, it's not true. They are a klisha malachto leheter, but you can't move a klisha malachto leheter just for anything you want. There needs to be a good reason, and here there's not enough of a good reason. We'll see that in a moment. Yes. No, you they rested on top of the loaves of bread. In the times of Nehemiah, the challah board was mukta.
Everything was mukta. Only knife.
No. Why would the challah be mukta? The buses.
No.
Prior to anything, right? The challah itself should be mukta.
So here's what they would do. They would take out the weeds on Erev Shabbos, right? And then they would take out the bread on Shabbos and they would eat it, right? And then they would put in the new bread without any weeds on Shabbos, and then on Motzai Shabbos they would put the weeds in between the loaves of bread. So that way the Netilas HaKanim and the Seder HaKanim would be done not on Shabbos, and on Shabbos itself there wouldn't be any issues of Muktzah. Was the table? Yes, the table was muktzah at that time. So you can put things down on top of muktzah, right? It happened to me lots of times, right, that I've been walking home and I needed to tie my shoe. Put your tiles bag on top of the nearest car, right? Not a problem at all, as long as you're not moving it. The gzeira is not to move muktzah, not to put things on top of muktzah. I remember I used this. There was one time that we had a guest, and this was back when we were first married, so we had a one-bedroom apartment. The guest was sleeping in the living room, and we wanted to use the living room also, so I figured out, I have this great idea, we'll just cover the lamps with a tablecloth, because there's no isser of moving, right, of putting things on top of muktzah. The isser is just, you know, moving muktzah. So then the problem with that was, is that it's a fire hazard, so we discovered, right, you know, we wanted to test it out, and we actually discovered that the tablecloth got, you know, really, really hot, and we decided that it wasn't such a good idea. But the Shabbos lamp, right, works, you know, kind of with that principle, right, that there's a lamp there, but you twist things around it, and that's not a problem, as long as the lamp itself, and the truth is that the lamp might be movable even, right, but in general, putting things down on top of muktzah is not a problem. Yes? Right, so the question is, it's a mitzvah in and of itself, and it's also something that you're doing to prepare for next Shabbos. My guess is that the character of that action as a mitzvah action, b'yom ha-shabbos, yarchenu, l'fnei Hashem tamid, it outweighs the fact that you also happen to be preparing it for next Shabbos.
But
it's an important halacha about hachana, and hachana is a very, very interesting category, and it really deserves a discussion, right, all by itself. But there's a basic rule of hachana, and that rule is that if something is going to take you more time on Motzai Shabbos, and so you're not just doing it on Shabbos to save yourself the same amount of time on Motzai Shabbos, that's a zilzul for Shabbos, right? It'll take me 10 minutes no matter when I do it. So you know what? I'll do it on Shabbos, so that way on Motzai Shabbos I can spend those 10 minutes playing a computer game. That's a zilzul for Shabbos. 10 minutes of Shabbos is far more precious than 10 minutes of Motzai Shabbos, and so all of those types of hachanos, right, are pushed to the side. However, if there's something which you cannot do as efficiently on Motzai Shabbos as on Shabbos, such as you put a dish in the sink, and you know that if you wait till Motzai Shabbos, it's going to get all crusted up, and it's going to take you hours to scrape off all of that crust. But on Shabbos, all you need to do, right, is give a couple of swishes, and all of that residue goes off, so that on Motzai Shabbos, all you need to do is get rid of the fat and the juices. Totally allowed, because on Shabbos, you're spending 1 minute to save yourself 10 minutes on Motzai Shabbos. And a person knows that if they keep the dishes in the sink until Motzai Shabbos, right, then they may not only have to clean the dishes, they might also have to get rid of bugs that are attracted to the dishes. So you clean the dishes on Shabbos, because again, you're not just, you know, exchanging 10 minutes of weekday time for 10 minutes of Shabbos time. That's a zilzul for Shabbos. What you're doing is you're doing something on Shabbos which can only be done on Shabbos. And even though by doing that you happen to be saving yourself a few minutes of weekday time, but it's not considered to be hachana, because this is something that can only be done on Shabbos. So in terms of the Seder HaKadim, if we're nervous that the bread is going to get moldy unless we put it in the freezer, unless we put it in the fridge, it's going to spoil it or something along those lines, so then it would be permissible to do whatever it takes in order to save the bread from spoiling, even though you're only going to eat the bread, right, on Motzai Shabbos. It's not considered hachana, because what you're doing on Shabbos is something which you could not do on Motzai Shabbos. You put a bookmark into your book when you're finished reading it. So you're only going to read it again on Sunday. Right, so isn't putting the bookmark in just a hachana for Sunday? Right, so the answer is that if you don't put the bookmark in, then you're going to end up having to flip through the pages and you might forget it and it's going to be frustrating. The only way that you can mark your place is by putting the bookmark in on Shabbos. That's a basic rule that if it's something that you can't do on Motzai Shabbos, there's no Isra of hachana. Yes, Alvin. The Kohanim would eat it. In fact, it was supposed to be that it was so filling that all you needed was like one bite, right, and you were already all full. So the Kohanim didn't need a challenge in the Beis HaMikdash, and all they needed was their bite of the Lechem upon him. That's what they had. It was a special bracha.
The sacrifices they had to make.
Yeah.
Why wasn't it?
You're like Mr. Berkowitz.
Instead of including the place on the Shabbat,
it's a good question. It's not 100% clear, and it's part of the sugya that we're going to discuss. I'll just give you a quick, foreshadowing of what's to come. Right? So the Gemara says, what are the chances that the bread is going to get moldy between, right, Shabbos 12 noon and Motzai Shabbos when you put in the meat? How much closer to molding it is it going to get? Chances are that it's not such a major need, the Gemara is going to say. And that's why you're not allowed to do it on Shabbos. To move around the Tisha Malachto Leheter needs to be for an important purpose. But this is not an important purpose because the utility of putting in the reeds, right, can be accomplished almost as well on Motzai Shabbos, and for that tiny extra bit, right, of utility, we don't permit moving around even a kli shemalachto leheter. That's going to be Rava or Rabba's response to Rabbi Elazar. So this establishes the idea that when you define something as being tzorech, something as being necessary, or something as enhancing Shabbos, it's not sufficient to have a small enhancement. It decreases the likelihood of moldiness from 2% to 1%. That's not enough of a tzorech to justify moving even a kli shemalachto leheter, and as a consequence of that, we have the bar pretty high. When we say it's a tzorech Shabbos, we say the bar is high, and it needs to be like a big tzorech rather than a small tzorech. Yes?
Putting stuff in the freezer on Shabbos, even though it's just improving a little bit because if you wait till after Shabbos, you could do it as well. Are you allowed to do that?
So let's say that you finish the Shabbos meal, and there's leftovers. You're not going to eat it for Shabbos. So this time, so you want to put it into the freezer. Now you could put it into the fridge, and then put it in the freezer on Motzai Shabbos. So is putting it into the freezer considered to be hachana for whenever it is that you're next going to be eating, right? Whether it's, whether it's challah or whether it's, leftovers from one of the dishes, or soup, meat, whatever it might be. So Reb Moshe Feinstein has a very interesting tshuva where he talks about what happens if children are visiting their grandparents for a sleepover, a Motzai Shabbos sleepover. And the sleepover is starting, right, on Shabbos itself. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says, are you allowed to dress the kids in pajamas and take them to their grandparents in pajamas? Or is that considered hachana because you're preparing them for bedtime, which is after Shabbos? So Rav Moshe gives, he could have justified it based on what we said, that, well, if you don't send them along with their pajamas, right, then you're going to have to make an extra trip, right? And so you're actually doing something on Shabbos, which you can't do on Motzai Shabbos, but it's not what he says. He gives a different explanation. He says that the reason that this is mutter is because you're allowed to do things normally on Shabbos. So that means that if the normal way that you take your kids for a sleepover is getting them in pajamas and then walking them to the grandparents, so you're allowed to do that on Shabbos as well, and there's no concern over there for hachana, because what you're doing is just following your normal routine for this particular objective. So I think the bookmark, also works. The idea there is, I'm not preparing for Sunday. It's just natural that when I put away And when I put away the, you know, the bookmark, when I put away the book, so I put a bookmark to mark my place. It's just the normal routine, and therefore there is no issue of hakana. So my understanding is, let's say it was a weekday, and you know, you finished a meal, right, whether it's like a Shabbat brachos meal, right, or something along those lines, or a meal with guests, you know, during the week, a Thanksgiving dinner, right, and then the natural thing to do then is to put the leftovers into the freezer if there's enough of them, you know, for the next time that you're having a festive meal. So I think that would be kind of just the routine when you're putting things away. So there are some things that you put away in the fridge, and there's other things that you put away in the freezer. The basic rule of Rav Moshe is you don't have to break your normal routine, right, in order, because that routine would result in gaining some extra time during the week. For a person to go out of their way, out of the normal routine, in order to, you know, to do extra things during the week, so that might be a problem, but to keep the normal routine is not necessarily going to be a problem. Okay, so there's a big discussion about putting dishes into a dishwasher on Shabbos, which I think is relevant to your question. So over there, you could really make, you know, two arguments. You could say, look, you know, leave them in your sink and you'll transfer them to the dishwasher on Motzai Shabbos. On the other hand, you could say that this is just a normal routine. You rinse off the dishes and then you put them in the dishwasher. Now, my understanding is that varies from household to household, meaning that there are some households where it's just, you know, having a full sink, right, is like an Isser D'oraisa, right? The kitchen has to be, you know, spotless, right, and clean. And as soon as you're done using something, right, you put it away in the dishwasher. So if that's the type of household that we're talking about, and then every single meal, every single day, right, as soon as you finish with your plate and your fork, you rinse it off and you put it in the dishwasher. So I think that there will be good grounds for putting it in the dishwasher on Shabbos as well. However, if the routine is to is to leave dishes in the sink sometimes when you're tired, when you're busy, and when there's more important things to do, sometimes you put it in the dishwasher, sometimes you leave it in the sink. So then on Shabbos, ideally, right, the dishes should be left in the sink unless, you know, you run out of room, in which case you can open up the dishwasher and put the dishes into the dishwasher, because at that point you're doing something which is not necessarily your normal routine. It's something that sometimes you do, but not always. And so that might constitute an act of hakana. So I think it's the same thing that, you know, in your case about putting the milk back in the fridge. If a person always puts the milk right back in the fridge, so then for sure that's allowed, because you don't have to break your normal routine in order to avoid hakana for the weekday. However, if a person ordinarily leaves the milk out for a couple of hours at a time, so then I think that there might be a problem putting it away on Shabbos. That's the type of thing that the Yetzer Hara will get you. Half the time, you know, you put the milk away right away, half the time you don't. So bedafka on Shabbos, they're going to have a Yetzer Hara to put the milk away right away. And if a person actually leaves it out, so that would be a shaila. I'm actually surprised. The only person I met who liked warm milk was the janitor in the yeshiva where I went to high school. That he used to love warm milk, and after breakfast was over, he would like consolidate all of the milk bottles and he would drink them because he didn't like the milk cold. He liked the milk warm. But so that's I think what the response would be for that. Yes. So hopefully we're going to get there. I haven't researched, you know, the topic more of Bona and Sosa, of building and destroying on Shabbos, but I think that one of the main sugyos is on that Kuf Vav, which is the end of this parak, and I'm really, really hoping that we'll get there before the end of Av. Yes. Okay, so if you're nervous that it's going to get spoiled, so then you can definitely put it away. It's an interesting question. It's a long Shabbos during the summer. Yeah, if you're worried it's going to get spoiled, then put it away. There's a chance that you'll use it again on Shabbos. No, here the question is like this. So let's say that there's leftover challah. Right, there's leftover tallin, and so the question is, do you leave it on the counter or do you put it in the fridge? So Adarab, if you leave it on the counter, it's going to taste a little bit better, right? Because room temp tallin is better than cold tallin. So if you're going to have it for Shabbos Chodesh, it might be better to leave it on the counter, unless you'll be too nervous to eat it because you're worried that that the meat got spoiled and it's no longer healthy. So that's sort of a toss up. And in my house, we put away the tallin after the Shabbos meal. We put it away in the fridge because we're nervous. And it's not going to last, you know, the entire afternoon. You know, it's not necessarily going to be healthy to eat afterwards. What? To take food out of the freezer? To put it in the freezer? No, like to put water in the freezer, it changes state, but food just becomes more firm. I don't think it actually undergoes a visible state transformation. No, to make water into ice cubes, I think that people sometimes are cautious about that because you're changing its state. First it's liquid, now it's solid, you can feel it, you can see it. That might be an issue of NOLED. I mean, I don't know whether MOLED is allowed even in the Torah Shabbos. The question is, what are the parameters of MOLED? Even defrosting, you know, ice cubes, they talk about, you know, do you put the ice cubes and then the liquid, or do you put the liquid and then the ice cubes? You want to do it as surreptitiously as possible, because part of the Isser of MOLED, unlike, by the way, the Isser of Hachana, part of the rationale for those Isurim is that we want to, to broadcast, right, a certain message. And so if a person just goes ahead and changes the state of object, the person just goes ahead and publicly prepares for Motzai Shabbos, so that's a public zilzol of Shabbos. It's a public, you know, basically shaming Shabbos in public, as opposed to if you do it surreptitiously. So even if, you know, you yourself are aware that you've done something which is a little bit out of the character on Shabbos, but you've preserved the public, you know, character of Shabbos, you haven't gotten in your face of anybody who might be watching. And so in general, these types of Yisurim, Malachos, not so, but when it comes to more spirit of the law, laws of Shabbos, like, you know, speaking and preparing and Molid, so there we tend to be a little bit more lenient when they're done surreptitiously. So you put the water first and then you put the ice cubes in, and so like you can't really tell that the ice cubes are melting, as opposed to if you put the ice cubes in and then you pour the water on top of it, when it's very apparent what's going on. And so even when it comes to melting ice cubes, there are procedures that are meant to be followed in order to preserve as much as possible the public character of Menuchas HaShabbos. Okay, shall we move on? Next Mishnah. Maklos. What's the deal with Maklos? So again, this takes you back to the Beis HaMikdash. In the times of the Beis HaMikdash, we used to have a Karban Pesach. Every Erev Pesach, they would shecht this Karban, and then they would skin the Karban Pesach. And the way that you skin the Karban Pesach is you put the animal onto a pole, and then you have a person who's an expert at skinning animals come and cut it a certain way, and then peel off the hide of the animal. However, when Erev Pesach fell out on a Shabbos, so they didn't put the animal on poles, because the poles were muktzah. Those maklos that were muktzah, and instead of putting it on poles, people would actually hold the animal, that people would put their hands on somebody else's shoulder, and you would tie the animal to the hands, like, so my hand would be on your hand would be on my shoulder, and then we would tie the animal to the hands, and then these professional furriers or skinners, I would then proceed to skin the animal that way, because the poles are muktzah and you're not allowed to use them. So again, according to Rabbi Elazar, the poles were only muktzah in the times of Nehemiah ben Nahalia, because everything was muktzah then, except for these couple of types of knives and sparim and shoes and maybe spoons and bowls. But according to Rava or Rabba, we'll see that perhaps even nowadays these poles for skinning the Karban Pesach were muktzah. Let's see that inside. Maklos, second to last line. Ditanan, Maklos dakin, they were thin poles. Chalakin, that were smooth. Hayusham, were there in the Beis HaMikdash. Umanicho al ksefo val kasef chaveiro, you would put the pole, one pole on your shoulder, one pole on somebody else's shoulder. Betola, you would hang the animal from the pole. Umashit, and take the skin off. But Amar Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Elazar says, Arba Asar Shechal Yois B'Shabbos, if Erev Pesach fell out on Shabbos, Maniach Yado Al Kasi Chaviro, you wouldn't put poles to hang the animals, but you just put your hand on your friend's shoulder, the Yad Chaviro Al Kseifo, and your friend will put his hand on your shoulder, the Tola, you would hang the animal from the hands, Umafshit, and skin it in that way. So again, the poles were muksa, according to Rabbi Elazar, that was only once upon a time. According to Rava Rava, it may even be nowadays. Let's see the other two. Glustra Ditnan Nagar. Sheyesh Verosho Glustra. If you have a bulb that has like a thick head on top of it, Rabbi Yeshua says, Shomta Min Pesach Zeh Betola Bechaveiro. You're allowed to sort of like, you know, knock it out of one door and then put it into a different door. But B'Shabbos, Rabbi Tarfon says, Harveyu kechol hakelim umitaltel b'chatzer, it's like anything else, and you can move it around, you can pick it up in the normal way. So again, we have this idea that Rabbi Yeshua says that you're not allowed to move it in the normal way. Oh, you have the glustra. Okay, so this, it's not exactly a Nagar Shehish Rosh or Glustra, but it sort of demonstrates the concept. You could use this as a bolt for a door, right? You have, you know, the two circles, right? One that's attached to the door, one that's attached to the door frame. Right? You put this in the middle. Now anybody who's trying to open the door, right? They're going to bang against each other. The door will not be able to open until you take it out. And then the door will be able to open, the two circles will be able to separate. However, it's also got this, you know, head, which you can use maybe for crushing spices or something along those lines. That's the Nagar Shiyesh Barosho Glustra. And again, Rashi says, Ra'ui Laduch Bashum, you can crush garlic with it, but really the main purpose is Noalin Bodalis, it's for locking doors with. And the halacha is, according to Rabbi Yeshua, Shomta Mipesach Zeh, Betola Bechavero, Afagav Nitzarech Legufo, even though you need actually the glustra and the nagar for its intended purpose, which is permitted on Shabbos, still Litloso Bechavero Lenolabo, still Shomto Al Yidei Gvira. You're only allowed to sort of pull it out indirectly, Minatzad, Aval Tiltul Gomer Lo, but you can't move it in regular, normal way. Afal Pishim Alachol Leheter. Even though that it's something whose main purpose and the purpose that you're using it for now are permitted on Shabbos. Lo shari leilat tzarech gufo. So that must be because of Netanya ben Chachalya's Zera. And then finally, the last one is Medocha, which we already learned. Thank you very much. The condition of Medocha is that Medocha, if it's got the garlic inside of it, you can move it. But if there's no garlic inside of it, you can't move it. Even though the main purpose seems to be storage, right, of garlic, you still can't move it because of Nechemiah's Gzeira. And Medocha ha de Amaron. So this is all Rabbi Elazar. Now along comes who's the challenger, the Bar Plugta of Rabbi Elazar, and this is very important. Who is the Bar Plugta of Rabbi Elazar? Look at the next line. Rabba? Rabba. Okay, so let's say that it's Rabba. Why is it important? Because Rabba holds that you can't move a klisha malachto leheter mecham alatzel. Rabba says that you could. So we paskin like Rabba, not like Rabba. Now, if Rabba is going to come along and he's going to give us these stringencies and say, oh, you can't move the maklos, right, for skinning the carbon pesach, and you can't move the kanim, right, for preserving the lechem upon him. So we're going to say, okay, that's Rabba. He says you can't move the maklos and the kanim even to protect them from damage. Right? But we paskin that you could protect them from damage, and if you can move them to protect them from damage, maybe you can move them for these purposes as well. So if Rabba is the one who's about to argue on Rabbi Elazar, we're going to take his interpretations of these Mishnayos with a grain of salt, because even though he says they're relevant nowadays, but we don't paskin like him. And so just like we marginalize these Mishnayos according to Rabbi Elazar, we might marginalize these Mishnayos according to Rabba as well. If it's Rabba, right, so then we've got to take it more seriously. Rabba says you're allowed to move the kanim or the maklos or the meducha or the glustera, even to protect them from getting damaged. And now Rabba's saying, but you can't move them. right, to, you know, to minimize the chances of the bread spoiling from 2% to 1%. You can't move the macros in order to make the ease of skinning the carbon Pesach, you know, from a level 50 ease to a level 51 ease. We have to bring it up at least 10 points or at least 20 points. If it's Rava, we'll have to take that more seriously, because Rava says you're allowed to move it even Michama Letzel. But yet he says you're not allowed to move it if it simply makes your Shabbos only one comfort point better. Right? It's got to be 10 comfort points better. So we're going to have to take that much more seriously, because Rava, even the permissive Rava, whom we paskin like, perhaps is being strict when it comes to these things. There is a machlokas yourselves about who is the Bar Pesach here. Our printed Gemara have Rava, but some Rishonim have Rava there. Rava is the Rabbi of Rava. So that the generation of Rava and Abaye was a generation when it flipped. In other words, that up until Rava and Abaye, we passed in always like a Rebbe against the Talmud. From Rava and Abaye onwards, we passed in like a Talmud against the Rebbe. And so that's exactly the generation when it flipped. So I'm not sure whether we passed in like Rava and Abaye against Rava or not. So let's take a look at Rava, Rabba's answers. Omer Rabba, Rabba says, Mimai, from where do you get this conclusion that these Mishnayos have no contemporary relevance, that they're all just illustrations of the historical process? Dilma, maybe, Le'olam Eimalachai, can always say to you, Le'achar Ataras Kelim Nishni, that these four Mishnayos that were taught, were composed after all the repeals were said and done. So Kanim Taim Amai, why are you not allowed to move those kanim for the lesson upanim, mishum iapushe. Right? The whole purpose of the kanim is to prevent ipush, it's to prevent the bread from getting moldy. The high porta in this small amount of time, between 12 noon on Shabbos and 9 p.m. on Motzai Shabbos, 9 hours, lo miapesh. The bread is not going to become moldy in 9 hours. And so there is no great need for putting these kanim in on Shabbos itself. It's not sufficient
meat. And taking them out from the
maklos. What about the poles? Why are those mukta? Why can't you move them to make it easier to skin the carbon Pesach? Because efsar kerebi alaza. You can skin the carbon Pesach using your hands just as well as using the poles. And so just to add a little bit of extra comfort and convenience, if it's only a little drop of comfort and convenience, we're not going to allow a person to move muktzah, even kli shemalachso leheter. And then glustra kedrebi yanai, the reason for glustra might have nothing to do with muktzah. It might be Gam Rabbi Yanai b'chatzer she'ina murevis haskina, and we're talking about a chatzer without an eruv. Rabbi Yeshua sabar tocha pesach kelefnim dami, that as long as you're inside the doorway, so you're, it's as if you're inside the house and you don't need an eruv. As opposed to Rabbi Tarfon, who says that the commentator mana the batim b'chatzer. If you take the bolt out of the doorway, so you're basically taking it from the house, because the inside of the doorway is a house, and you're taking it out to the chatzer, which doesn't have an eruv, and that's a problem of taking things from one rishus to another rishus, from a place that's privately owned to a place that is collectively owned, and that would be a problem, as opposed to Rabbi Tarfon, who says, Rabbi Tarfon Savar Tocha Pesach Kilachutz Dami, that the doorway is part of the chaser, so that means that the space under the door frame is collectively owned, just like the chaser is collectively owned, and since it's not owned by the public, but just by a small cooperative, therefore you're allowed to move from one end of the cooperative property to the other one without an eruv, he says, and therefore it's Tocha Pesach Kilachutz Dami, Umana de chaser. The chatzer comes out, and you're carrying something from one end of the collective property to the other end of the collective property, but you're not taking it from one rishus to another rishus, from something that's privately owned to something that is cooperatively owned. And so that's the machlokas, as if we have nothing to do with muktzah, everything to do with rishuyos and eruvin. And finally, midocha, Rabbi Nechemya, who says that you can only carry it for its intended purpose. So let me just quickly tell you what the halacha l'maisa relevance is of this Rava's dechia, and then maybe next week in Yerushalayim, hopefully, we'll we'll go a little bit more in depth into how the poskim, emerge with this halacha. The Shulchan Aruch paskim that a kli shemalachto leheter, in other words, something whose main purpose is totally permitted on Shabbat, cannot be moved for no reason at all. There must be a reason for moving a kli shemalachto leheter on Shabbat. So that means, for example, right, that if you have a pair of glasses and they're on the table right over here, and you have no reason to move them from one place to another, but you feel like it, the Shulchan Aruch would say, don't move it because there's no reason to move it. The same thing is true about anything else. Let's say that there is a fork on the table, right, and you want to pick it up and just twiddle it in your fingers, right? Is there a reason for doing that? So, if you see somebody else at your table twiddling his fork, do you have to stop him? I didn't even need a scenario, but we'll do that on Monday. So that's a shaila, even though the posts say that it's actually very, very important to twiddle your fork or to twirl around your glass. They say that's very important for Menuchas HaShabbos, and if you see somebody doing it, so you don't have to stop them, because if it wasn't important, then you probably wouldn't be doing it. And if everybody does it, then there must be some sort of like a deep psychological reason that people do it for. The nafkamina would be that if a person could get out of that habit, that if a person could be more aware of where their hands are going, and maybe like if you actually say like, hey, wait a second, why am I twirling around this glass on its stem, and is that really important? Is it can I get the stress benefits from in some other way? So if a person actually is having this type of conscious reflection on what they're doing at the Shabbos table, at that point it probably is a good idea to put the glass down and to do something else. But as long as the person's doing it in sort of like a mindless way, so it's going to sap their energy to like keep on concentrating, like don't touch the glass, don't twiddle the fork, whatever it is. But once a person's already thinking along those lines, it might actually be a good idea to put it down. So this is the track of the Shulchan Aruch.
Is that the
Ramah? Yes. The Ramah doesn't argue on this. The Aruch HaShulchan is the one who argues on this. The Aruch HaShulchan says, everything that we do for a purpose. If there was no purpose, we wouldn't do it. So therefore, the Aruch HaShulchan says, it's a category that doesn't have anything inside of it, he says. Because everything we do for a purpose. And if we're doing it, there must be a purpose. And so there's no such thing as moving a key, right, for no reason whatsoever. Right? But again, in the Gemara here, that according to Rabba Rava, there is such a thing as doing it for no purpose whatsoever. I'm making a calculation. I don't want it to get moldy. Right? So I'm going to put in these kanim. No. If I'm making a real calculation, the kanim, putting them in on Shabbos, is not going to make any difference at all. So I'm not doing this for like the psychological, comfort, whatever it is. I'm doing this just statistically data-driven, right? Data-driven. And if I'm a very data-driven person and I understand that based on the data, there's no need at all for moving this muksa, so then you're not allowed to move it, even though it's a kli shemalachto leheter. But if you're not so data-driven, okay, or if you're not sure what the data is, right, so then you can make the Aruch HaShulchan's argument. But in a case like this, where the data all indicates that there's no need at all, and you're doing it based on the data and not based on a nervousness or a feeling or an emotion, right, that would be the type of case when a kli shemalachto leheter even would not be allowed to be moved. Okay, so we're gonna talk a little bit more. Right, again, no, so that's what you don't need to do. That's Aruch HaShulchan. right? Meaning a person can't sap their energy on Shabbos worrying about every piece of malach v'lehato that they pick up. But once they are aware of what they're doing, right? So then perhaps they should put it down. But again, you don't just... It's perfect.